Welcome to the Executive Podcast, the show where we talk to the individuals behind the scenes of successful businesses. They provide us with valuable insights, tips, and their unique perspectives, which have fueled both their successes and challenges. In this episode of the Executive Podcast, we speak to Eleanor Bradford, the Head of Corporate Communications at Spay. Spay is a PR and marketing agency headquartered in Speyside, with supporting offices in the historic port of Leith. Spay provides consumer and corporate PR, social media and content services in Scotland and beyond. Eleanor herself has had a varied career, having worked as a journalist and spending a spell at the BBC before going on to PR. She's also put herself out there after she went through an adoption crisis that saw her both scrutinised and praised in the media. We talked to her about this and more. Welcome, Eleanor, to the Executive Podcast, and thank you for agreeing to be here. I guess my first question for you is, I want to take you back to first job. What was your first ever job and what were you like as an employee?
I think my first job actually was selling glass as a Saturday girl in a department store that was called Owen Owen, which one of many department stores that no longer exists. But if you know me, you'll know how ridiculous that was, because literally I get through a box of glasses in my own home every 6 months. But the good thing about it was that my boss broke more glass than I did, incredibly. So between us, there used to be a lot of accidents in that department. But I suppose it was just accidental that I fell into that role, but it was probably a great role in terms of forcing you to learn how to speak to strangers and to engage with strangers. Probably didn't want to talk to you, but you had to kind of get them to talk to you anyway. And that ended up being very good training for my career.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have had a very varied career. You know, you've worked for the BBC, you've done columnists, and now you're head of corporate PR at Spay. Tell me about your career. What's been the highlights? You know, how have all those transitions gone?
Well, for most of my career, I was a journalist and I fell into that by accident. I always knew I wanted to work in the media. I didn't know I wanted to be a journalist until I started volunteering at a radio station that was close to my university. And it was the journalists in the newsroom who sort of convinced me that that was the way to go, mainly because it was a firmer career path. You know, I didn't come from any kind of background where I had parents to support me financially, although they were always supportive, but I needed to earn a living. So in those days, it wasn't quite so hard to become a journalist. So I went off and did my postgraduate journalism diploma and then got a job working, first of all, down in the southwest of England, which was a lovely, lovely place to work, but nothing ever happened down there. I mean, one journalist got one story a day and the whole of the rest of the programme was just fluff. And so after a couple of years, I realised that I needed something a bit more challenging. And I applied for a job in Northern Ireland and a job in Scotland. And this was just before devolution in Scotland. So they were looking for a whole load of journalists to come and help cover devolution. And I got the Scottish job, which actually turned out to be the best thing that could have happened, because not long after, Northern Ireland entered the peace process. And although it was still busy there, it wasn't as busy as it had been before, whereas Scotland had the Scottish Parliament and then the independence referendum. And so it turned out being probably the best place in the UK, I think, to really start covering big, interesting, you know, nationally important stories. And then I became health correspondent for BBC Scotland again, sort of fell into it by accident. And that was a fascinating role. I mean, just fascinating. And the thing I think that's a privilege when you're a journalist is that you meet people, everyone you meet on a daily basis is at a point in their life that's really significant. To you, it's just another story. You know, it's just the story that you're covering that day. But the fact that they're being interviewed by the BBC that day means that they have done something significant. And I remember speaking to one researcher once. He was a scientist and he had made a big discovery in his field. And I said to him, you know, how long has it taken you to reach this point? And it had taken him 20 years. So his entire career he had spent reaching this point. I'm hesitating to use the word breakthrough because I know scientists hate it when you use the word breakthrough. But in the world of journalism, you would say it was a breakthrough. And yeah, so that's your sort of daily life. I mean, it can be incredibly traumatic, especially in the health field. I met a lot of people who, you know, had received the diagnosis that no one ever wants to receive, and were dealing with that. As well as being very humbling, it's very sobering. You realize that we all think, you know, we're going to live forever, and life is short, and life is very fragile. So that changed my outlook on life quite a bit. Didn't meet that many celebs. The ones I met didn't really. David Attenborough was lovely, but I only happened to meet him in reception. But, you know, not a huge fan of the celebs I met, but I met some incredible people. I met two of the surviving people at that time who'd invented the ultrasound machine. I met the scientist who found the cure for TB. You know, so you do meet some remarkable people. Yes, that was an amazing time in my life. But I just reached the point where I've been doing it a long time. You know, at that time when I left the BBC, there were issues in terms of women's pay and women's career advancement in particular. I wanted to move into management, which wasn't a typical career path for a journalist. And I found that people with less experience who hadn't followed the same career path were being promoted ahead of me, which I know happens in lots of roles, but I found that frustrating. So I ended up leaving. And first of all, I went to the University of Aberdeen and looked after their communications. Then I joined SPAE when it was fairly young and newly established. And then I went to look after the communications for Gordonstoun for a few years, and now back at SPAE.
So a very varied career and very interesting. And I mean, I guess I probably just want to touch on a couple of points there. You talked especially about your journalism career, because it does relate to business in a lot of ways. You know, it is that in itself, really, being a journalist in a lot of ways. And you've discussed a few stories you worked on, but was there any story in particular that you were like, I'm so glad I did that, or that still you remember it was like a favourite thing you worked on, or was a real piece of like campaign journalism that meant a lot to you?
I think I was health correspondent for 15 years, and probably more than half of that time, I followed the tainted blood scandal and worked with the guys who were all affected by that, and a couple of women as well, but mostly men. And it was frustrating because during my time in highlighting that scandal, they didn't receive any compensation. But after I left, things moved fairly quickly, and they have now had an inquiry. There has been some compensation, certainly more than they were initially offered, which was just ridiculously low. So it has been, you know, gratifying to have played a part in that. And I think having their story told on the BBC did make a difference to that group of people. I think it was high profile enough to get the attention of the Scottish Parliament, and to force there to be an inquiry. So yeah, that was an important story. Yeah, I mean, there've been other times. It all got very hectic around the time of the Scottish referendum. We were all under intense scrutiny and all being accused. Everyone's accused of bias. You know, no matter how straight down the line you played it, someone accused you of bias. So it was a very difficult time, but also a very interesting and exciting time. Sometimes it's the individual stories that you remember, the individuals who've been really treated very badly. And sometimes for them, you could get an instant result. People who had been turned down for operations that you could see, you know, were clearly life-changing operations that they were entitled to. And when you put their story in the media, then they got that operation and turned around their life. And it was justice. It was a form of justice for people who'd been denied any other kind of justice. And that was very satisfying.
It's definitely one of the most rewarding parts of the job, certainly. And I guess you talked as well about, you know, it came to this point where you wanted to move up, you wanted this management role, and it just wasn't happening. I guess, how was that? Could you have stayed and fought that? Or was that just going to take too much of you? Or had you already tried to do that? Was it easier to just leave? And I guess, you know, in journalism, they talk about going to the dark side in PR. Was it just easier to do that than it would have been to stay and fight?
It was definitely easier to leave and get that kind of role. It wasn't an easy transition into PR. The thing I found was that the actual PR side of it in terms of working with the media was very easy. I found that very easy. What I hadn't really factored in was the strategic side of it and how difficult it is sometimes to convince the people who run big organizations that they need to foster good relationships with the media, and they can't just issue a press release when it suits them and expect a sympathetic response. You need to develop ongoing relationships with the media in good times and in bad. You need to help the media do their job and not just ask the media to do things for you. And that to me was obvious, but trying to convince people who were afraid of the media, who saw the media as the enemy and who were suspicious of the media, that it's a good idea to have a cup of coffee with the journalist was, I think, a big learning point for me. And also just understanding and trying to bring together what the media needs and what business needs, and trying to show both sides that they have areas in common. And it's not always a battle. It's actually a mutually beneficial relationship, but it is a business relationship. It's not a friendship. It's a business relationship, but it can be mutually beneficial. Trying to do that was a learning curve. But going back to your question, I could have stayed and I could have made a difference myself. But I think having left the BBC, I now realise that I was quite institutionalised. I think we all hate that word. And if I were to say to my friends, you still work there, that they're institutionalised, they'd be offended, and rightly so, because it's an amazing place to work and incredibly dynamic. And my goodness, the amount you achieve every single day is unbelievable. But I had been there a long time, and I think it was the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do to leave and see different environments. And I wish, you know what, the one thing I do wish is that I wish there was an environment in which more journalists could work in business before becoming journalists, or take a career break and go work in business before they go back to being a journalist. Because most journalists have never been anything else than be a journalist and have never worked in business. Your understanding of the way the world works is completely different. If you even get the slightest taste of, you know, the world outside journalism, and especially perhaps outside the BBC, which is publicly funded. So it's a little bit insulated from funding problems.
Yeah, there's maybe not the full reality of what's going on in the outside world and what you're reporting on.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a very, very difficult time for the media at the moment in terms of the way it's funded. And that goes for the BBC as well. I mean, actually, it's been really good to see the way the Northern Scot has modernised itself, and the executive newsletter that comes out and things like this, and, you know, making sure that it appeals to different aspects of the communities within the catchment area. That's been brilliant to see, actually. But funding for the news media is really at a crisis point, because everyone expects to get their news for free and no one wants to pay anything for it. And then, you know, when you have a situation like we've got at the moment with Kate Middleton and all the conspiracy theories, it makes you realise how desperately we need sources of reliable information, particularly for younger audiences. So we need journalism more than ever, and yet we're less likely than ever to pay the wages of journalists.
It's very true. It is very true. And yeah, we're definitely seeing that just every day now. And I guess, so going to where you are now at SPAE, can you tell me more about SPAE's new tool for monitoring, is it sustainability, is that correct? Sustainable PR practices?
Yeah, so what we're trying to do is help all the brands that we work with think about everything they do, you know, when they're measuring how sustainable they are. A lot of brands now measure their carbon footprint, but they don't necessarily think about their PR activity. So we invite journalists to events, we send out samples, we make videos, we travel to meetings, amongst many other aspects of our PR work. And a lot of that isn't measured, but it can have a huge carbon footprint if we're flying to meetings in London, if we're flying journalists up from London, if we're sending out, you know, samples in packaging that can't be recycled or packaging that's too big. So what we've done is we've worked with a company that's expert in measuring the carbon footprint of all that kind of activity. And we've created a tool so that when we're planning all these events for journalists, we can advise clients about simple switches they can make to reduce the impact. So yes, you can take the train instead of flying, but actually, if you go in economy class rather than first class, that reduces your carbon impact, because the carbon impact of first class is higher because there are fewer people in the carriage. So there are lots of really, really simple things that can be done that make a big difference. And we think we're the first PR agency to offer this kind of tool. We don't know of any other. The specialist marketing agencies I've already spoken to about this don't know of any other. So we think we're the first, which is quite an exciting thing for a company, you know, from Murray to be able to claim. And, you know, we hope that the brands we work with and new brands that might like to work with us would like to use this tool, you know, as part of their corporate social responsibility and environmental responsibility.
It's very forward thinking, especially, you know, where you say where you're based, to be doing that and to hopefully be the first one to have done it. And I guess, how much do customers and clients look for what businesses are doing in terms of a corporate social responsibility? Is that more determinative for people and where they shop than it used to be before?
We know that it does. Now, I had all the stats to hand when I was looking at all this over Christmas. Every at the end of every year, you get lots and lots of reports about consumer behaviour and what's going to influence people's behaviour in the year ahead. And we know that the environmental impact of products are a big driver in the way people shop and what they choose. And obviously, we represent a variety of clients. Some of them have products that, you know, you would see in shops, and others are more part of the supply chain. So yes, it's being driven by consumer behaviour, but also there is just the expectation of society now, and also legal constraints that are coming in. So for a whole variety of reasons, organisations are looking at their carbon impact and their environmental impact. But some of them are being a little bit more tricky in the way they measure it than others. So we're just making sure that the whole supply chain is included and not just the bits they want to measure.
Unlock exclusive content from all our newspaper titles with the Highland News and Media Digital Plus subscription. Get access to news in your area online through e-edition, or take the headlines on the go with our user-friendly app. With news at your fingertips wherever life takes you, all this for £49.88 a year. Subscribe now at hnmmedia.co.uk to stay informed, connected, and engaged with Digital Plus.
What is it you enjoy about the job? What does a day in the life look like for Eleanor at SPAE?
So SPAE is a PR and communications agency that is based in Murray. We're set up in Murray, but also has an office in the Port of Leith in Edinburgh. And we look after mostly PR, also things like content, things like videos, social media, influencer engagement for a variety of companies in Murray and in Scotland and in the UK. They tend to be in the food and drink sector, in the sustainability sector, and in the education sector. So a typical day for me would be a mixture of working with my team to write media releases for those organisations, having meetings with the organisations to see what's coming up down the track for them, things they want to shout about, issues that are making their life difficult that I think we should highlight to the media, what we call thought leadership pieces, where I'm working with them on opinion pieces and ways in which we can influence the debate. It's really important, I think, a really important part of the PR role is not just to issue media releases and react to things, but actually influence what the media is talking about. And as a former journalist, one of the things I'm always saying to my clients is you have to be involved in that debate to shape it. If you don't get involved, then the debate will become skewed. And that's when we get bad policy. And you can get involved in that debate publicly, or you can do it behind the scenes, but it's just important to get involved. And then we might be talking about a brand video and what we're going to include in that brand video. Yeah, it's very varied. And then sometimes my colleagues are sending out samples of whiskey to journalists who are going to write about that whiskey. And or we might be planning an event. We've got an event at the Spiritus Bayside Whiskey Festival. So it's very varied. It's particularly varied for me because I oversee, you know, a number of clients and a team that work on all those accounts. Yeah, so every day is different. And then there's always a curveball.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, the curveballs, when things maybe crop up that maybe companies don't necessarily want the media to know. Is that part of you dealing with that, or is that another team? How does that transpire?
Yeah, it's we do what's called crisis communications. So we definitely look after that. It's rare that I have a situation with a company where they don't want the media to know something. And I think in this day and age, it's very unwise to think that something you do is never going to become public, especially in the days of social media. So it's more about managing those situations that are almost inevitably going to become public. They don't always, but there is a good chance. And sometimes as well, the way you manage them, and that includes internal communications, which we also look after, the way you manage them can have a big impact on how those situations develop. If you keep your staff properly informed, if you are involving them in the decisions that you're making, if you put your hands up and own your mistakes, I think that can create a very different environment to the one where you, in an old-fashioned environment, you want no one to know, you tell everyone not to talk about it, you tell your staff not to say anything and not to put anything on social media, and you bury your head in the sand. And that doesn't really work. And again, it's also this issue of coming back to your relationships with journalists as well. That, you know, you don't want to be having your first interaction with a journalist when you're in a crisis. If you have journalists that you've spoken to over a long period of time about all the things that your company is doing, when you are in a situation where you've maybe made a mistake or something has gone wrong, or there's a, you know, member of staff that's done something wrong, the journalist is much more likely to see that and within the perspective of all the things you do and not just the story that they do today and forget about tomorrow.
No, I think that's very helpful for a lot of businesses to know. And I guess we maybe see it with politicians as well, though. You know, we watch this kind of media landscape where they're not owning up to things or admitting things. And I guess it breeds that, you know, resentment that people have or mistrust of what's going on in life. And businesses can, I guess, be the model for actually how to do it well and how to do it good. And do you think that they manage it better than maybe politicians do?
Gosh, I don't know about that. I think some politicians are very skilled communicators and some business leaders are very skilled communicators. But the other myth is that journalists are only interested in bad news. You know, that's not true at all. The reality is, as you will know, and if you ever worked as a journalist, you will know, is that often it's only the bad news you get to hear about because people are not so good at shouting about the good news. And I think one of the skills that we have, that good people in the PR industry have, is that we can spot those good stories and we know how to make the most out of those. But just like any story, it has to be significant, you know, and this is the other thing that I haven't, you know, always have an uphill battle sometimes, is explaining the difference between advertising and news. And this is where PR comes in. So PR is not advertising. PR is about telling the world what you're doing in an authentic way about the newsworthy things that you are doing. But it's up to the, you know, it's the, you're leaving the journalists to interpret that and to put it in context. And there's an element of, you know, not having complete control over the process. But if what you're doing is good, what you're saying is genuine, then there's nothing to fear.
Talking about genuine, that kind of brings me into a question that's probably more personal for you, in that you, a couple of years ago now, were very genuine online with what was going on in your life in terms of adoption and family life. And I just wanted to ask if you could give us a bit of background on that, first of all, of what led you to kind of completely open yourself and be vulnerable to the whole world.
Well, I mean, I had a column. I still have. I am a columnist with the Press and Journal. And so I write about all kinds of things. And I'd always written, you know, about adoption when it cropped up. When I first adopted my two sons, You know, that was in the papers at the time because I was on screen. So right from the very beginning, it had been public knowledge. And then, like many adopted families, adoptive families, when our eldest child entered the teenage years, it started to be extremely challenging. And what I know now, which I didn't know at the time, is that this is incredibly common, and nearly half of all families with adopted children aged from 13 to 25 are in crisis or are facing severe challenges. And that's according to the largest survey of adoptive families that we have. Now, we don't know how many of those adoptions break down because no one accurately collects those figures. And independent research has shown that no one accurately collects those figures. But I was in a situation which pretty much mirrored actually what that survey of adoptive families found, in that one of my adoptions was going extremely well and the other one was in crisis. Unfortunately, you know, the one that was in crisis deteriorated to the point where we couldn't carry on. And what made me really, people at the time said that I was brave in speaking out, but I wasn't being brave. I was really angry. I was really angry about how badly we'd been let down by the system, because children going into care come from the most severe backgrounds. If they weren't severe, they wouldn't be put up for adoption. They would continue to have a relationship with their birth parents. But these children have come from a background of abuse that is so severe, they can't have an ongoing relationship with their birth parents, or it's a very distant one. And yet, when you become an adopted parent to them, you think that you'll have access to therapy, to support, you know, to expertise. You get absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. The children who have gone through this incredible trauma, who there is mountains of evidence about how this affects their behavior, and yet you get absolutely no therapeutic support for them whatsoever. What you're told is that you must be the therapist. So as well as trying to hold down a job and a career and dealing with an extremely challenging child or children, you're then expected to go off and get, you know, basically a degree in therapeutic care. And you're told, you know, it's called therapeutic parenting, which, yes, you need to understand what is going on in your child's brain, but that expectation that you have the skills to deal with it is totally unrealistic. So, our experience was horrific. We're still actually recovering from what we went through. But since going public about that, I have now been in touch with lots of other families who've been through the same thing. And I'm a member of a couple of groups that are trying to, they're mainly support-driven groups, but they're also trying to change policy and, most importantly, get accurate figures to get an understanding of how many adoptions are breaking down. Because what seems to be the case is, what we definitely know is that the profile of children entering the adoption system has changed. If you watch these programs, you know, about children who are reunited with, you know, the parents who've, you know, gave them up for adoption because they were unmarried, those are lovely programs. But if you look at the age profile of the people involved, that tells you everything about, you know, the way adoption has changed, because the children who are entering the adoption system now and over the past, you know, few decades have basically come from a background of severe abuse and neglect, alcoholism, drug use. And they, you know, as a result, they have extreme behavioral issues. So, you know, I will always speak out in support of families. What I would say is that if there are any adoptive families listening to this who have teenage children who are facing severe challenges, then they should understand that they're not alone, and that how common it is. But also what I would say is, you know, both my employers at the time I was going through this, because it went on for several years, really, for about 3 or 4 years. And I was working here at Spey at the time and also at Gordonstone. And my employers, both of them, were fantastically supportive. And that can be really key. So if you are an employer and you have employees who you know are adopted parents, then just being supportive. You don't necessarily have to do anything that costs you anything. You know, just giving them your support, just understanding that they are dealing with behaviour that is so extreme. It's really beyond your wildest expectation. I mean, I know parents who've been left permanently physically injured by their adopted children. I know parents who've been sexually harassed and abused by their adopted children. And that's not to say that that happens in every adoption case, but in the extreme examples, you know, extreme end of the spectrum, it is extreme, you know, extremely severe. So, you know, as an employer, just giving them your support. You know, they may need time off for social work meetings and meetings with school. You know, the system does not recognise the fact that you have a job and that you can't spend an afternoon every week in meetings with social workers and teachers. But yeah, that meant just having the support of my employers at the time, you know, made a huge difference to me. So yeah. So that's a small plea from me.
No, that's, thank you for that. The question I wanted to ask coming on from that is, you wrote about it and there was a lot of, I guess, scrutiny that came at your decision, at what you'd done, and a lot of anger and people spitting feathers. How did you get through that?
I think one of the frustrating things was that I couldn't tell the entire story and I still can't. So there were things going on that, due to data protection my son, I can't give the full range of what was going on. Well, I can actually, but you can't publish it. So if anyone sees me out and about and wants to talk to me about it, I'm quite happy to talk to them about it. But I just can't, or news organisations cannot publish that information. So people were judging me on only half the picture, but it was enough of the picture, I felt, that, you know, was part of a pattern, as I was explaining, about what adoptive families are going through that needed to be highlighted. But also, to be honest, what I was getting was lots and lots of people reaching out to me saying, this has happened to us too. We're in the same situation as you. People who that day, the day my column was published, that day had a social worker come to their home to pick up their child because they could no longer care for them because their behaviour was beyond what they could deal with. So although there was a lot of chatter on social media, in a way, being a journalist, you know, I'd always had that. As a journalist, you know, everything you do is scrutinised and picked apart and criticised. And to be honest, a lot of it I didn't really look at. What I do, I think the way to cope with things like that, and again, you know, for business, this might be useful. If you're someone in a business who has a public profile, don't look at all the nasty stuff yourself. Get someone else to look at it and to give you a summary. Get them to tell you if there's anything that you need to worry about or deal with. And if it's just people mouthing off, you know, get them to tell you what the issues are. And, you know, that's enough. So I understood that, you know, people who adopted themselves were very triggered by what I was saying. I don't think that I gave the impression that, you know, adopted children, you know, can be picked up and just returned on a whim. That was not, I think, the story that I told at all. And, you know, there is also the issue around whether or not I was discouraging people from adoption. I think if there was better support, I think firstly, not talking about the issue does not make it better. this issue is only becoming bigger and only getting worse. So what we need to do is actually talk about it. We need to explain what can be done so that children are not returned to care, because the situation we were in was not, you know, our situation became that extreme because of a lack of support. If it hadn't been for that lack of support, we wouldn't have reached that point. We understood why our child was behaving the way he does. Doesn't mean that you can cope with it just because you understand that this is something that he can't help. So, you know, yeah, it's, I sort of felt that going public about that whole situation was more important than upsetting, you know, the people that are upset by it, because it's only by, you know, showing the world what is going on, and it is an absolute scandal what is going on. You know, families are, you know, people are losing their jobs over this, their relationships are breaking down, and I know of suicides of parents who have completed suicide as a result of the way they've been treated by the whole system. It is an absolute scandal. And, you know, the people who have gone through this are getting angry and are becoming more vocal. So I think it's an area that you will hear more about as the years go on. I think they've been particularly fired up actually by the post office drama, and thinking that, you know, that's, they want to tell their story as well. So yeah, it's I'm not the last that's going to be in this situation and talk about it. And everybody's stories are sadly similar. And that's because the system is broken.
Would you, in hindsight, do anything different from the way that you told that story when you did it to begin with? Would you change how you did it or how you wrote it?
That's a good question. I don't think there's an easy way to tell that story. I think that I told it to the best of my ability, given that I was still right in the heart of what was going on. You know, the slight irony of this, yeah, I heard a charity, you know, on the radio the following day, and one of their criticisms of me was that I was a good communicator. And not long after, I heard a podcast with a woman who had had years of being stalked, and the police weren't doing enough to protect her from her stalker. And she got the law changed, I think. And she was accused of just being a good communicator. It's as if, you know, we're accused of over-exaggerating the situation because we're good communicators. And actually, there's an element of misogyny about that. And do you know what? It's not that we're good communicators. It's that the situation we were in was absolutely unbelievable and indefensible. And you don't have to be a skilled communicator to tell your story. It's just your story. So I think then, you know, I think it's a shame that some of the people who criticized me at the time didn't just reach out to me and see how we could work together to make the situation better, because if they'd done that, we'd have already made more progress by now.
That's really interesting and thought-provoking, so thank you for that. And I guess, looking at everything you've gone through, your life, your career, where you're at now, what is one thing, if you could go back and tell yourself something that you know now, what would you tell, say, 20-year-old Eleanor? What would be the piece of advice you would give yourself that you know now?
I would probably say, career-wise, be more patient. I think I was very impatient to get on and do the next thing and, you know, be promoted and all that kind of thing. And sometimes it's not just those things that take time, it's that actually you learn valuable stuff whilst you're moving up the ladder. There are always going to be frustrations with people who you think are not as well qualified, who seem to jump ahead. That's always going to happen in every role. you never know what's around the corner. Sometimes things can look really bleak or look really frustrating, but you don't know how quickly things can change in organizations. All of a sudden, a manager who's been making your life an absolute misery, and you leave that job. And then 2 months later, they've left, and you could have stayed, and it would have all been fine. But on the other hand, I think, as I mentioned right at the very beginning, the one thing I have learned from the health correspondent job is that life is short. And, you know, if you don't like your life, change things around. You know, do something different. Don't stay in a job you hate. Don't put off, you know, scary things that might be amazing. Especially, I think, to the younger generation today who seem, you know, to sometimes be quite anxious, especially about things like public speaking. You know, I wasn't a natural public speaker by any means. It took a lot of hard work to be able to work in broadcast media. And like any skill, you can just get better at it. And being able to stand in front of a group of people and speak is such a valuable skill. Don't not do it, especially women. Don't not do it because you think they're going to judge you on the way you look, or whether you get a sentence wrong, or whether you will and are. Go for it. And don't worry about that stuff. And realise that it's not going to be perfect, but you will get better and better the more you do it.
No, that's fabulous advice. I love it. And that brings it back to everything being authentic and genuine. I love it. No, thank you so much for your time, Eleanor. It has been so appreciated.
No worries.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Executive Podcast. You can sign up to our free newsletter at hnmedia.co.uk/executive magazine. We partner with stakeholders to keep you up to date with everything that is happening across all sectors within the North of Scotland economy.